doctor, the latter told an inquiring chaplain before the movement got underway. I do not know whether we march north, south, east, or west, or whether we will march at all. General Jackson has simply ordered me to have the division ready to move at dawn. I have been ready ever since and have no further indication of his plans. That is almost all I ever know of his designs. Stonewall was still Stonewall, especially when secrecy was involved, and no one, not even Robert E. Lee, of whom he said, "I am willing to follow him blindfolded," was going to change him. The result, as Lee had feared, was mutual resentment and mistrust. Not only did Jackson not consult with his red-haired lieutenant, whose so-called light division was as large as the other two combined, he rode him unmercifully for every slight infraction of the rules long since established for the Army of the Valley. Consequently, glad as he had been to get away from Longstreet, Hill began to suspect that he had leaped from the frying pan into the fire. Resentment bred confusion, and confusion mounted quickly toward a climax in the course of the march northward against Pope. Having reached Orange in good order the first day, August 7th, Jackson issued instructions for the advance across the Rapidan tomorrow, which would place his army in position for a strike at Culpeper the following day. The order of march would be Ewell, Hill, Winder, so he said. But during the night he changed his mind and told Ewell to take an alternate road. Uninformed of the change, Hill had his men lined up next morning on the outskirts of town, waiting for Ewell to take the lead. That was where Jackson found him. Angry at the delay, he rebuked him and passed Winder to the front. The result was further delay and a miserable showing, complicated by Federal cavalry probing at his wagon train. Ewell made barely 8 miles before sundown, Winder about half that, and Hill was less than 2 miles out of Orange when the army halted for the night. Jackson was furious. So was Hill. Ewell fretted. Winder was down with fever, riding in an ambulance despite his doctor's orders that he leave the field entirely. Several men had died of sunstroke, and the rest took their cue from their commanders, grumbling at the way they had been shuffled about in the dust and heat. Overnight, Jackson's wrath turned to gloom. The fast-stepping Army of the Valley, formerly such a close-stitched organization, seemed to be coming apart at the seams. Rising next morning to resume the march, he informed Lee, "I am not making much progress. Today I do not expect much more than to close up the column and clear the country around the train of the enemy's cavalry. I fear that the expedition will, in consequence of my tardy movements, be productive of but little good." Ewell had the lead. Winder was in close support. Hill was marching hard to close the gap. The morning wore on, hot as yesterday. Noon came and went. Presently, up ahead, there was the boom of guns, and word came back to Jackson that the Federals were making a stand, apparently with horse artillery. He rode forward and made a brief reconnaissance. This was Piedmont country, rolling, heavily wooded except for scattered fields of grain. The Bluecoats did not appear to be present in strength, but there was no real telling. Jackson decided to wait for Hill before advancing. Off to the right was Cedar Mountain, obviously the key to the position. Ewell was told to put his batteries there and his infantry below them, along the northern base. Winder would take position on the left in order to overlap the Yankee line when the signal was given to go forward. There was no hurry. It was now past 2 o'clock, and Culpeper was 8 miles away, too far in any event for an attack to be made on it today. Jackson went onto the porch of a nearby farmhouse and lay down to take a nap. Meanwhile, the artillery duel continued, the Union guns firing accurately and fast. This was clearly something more than a mere delaying action staged by cavalry. There was infantry out there beyond the woods, though in what strength could not be told. Manifestly weak, pale as his shirt, he was in fact in his shirt sleeves, Winder had left his ambulance, ignoring the doctor's protests, put his troops in line, extending the left as instructed, and then had joined his batteries, observing their fire with binoculars and calling out corrections for the gunners. It was now about 4 o'clock. An officer went down alongside him, clipped on the head by a fragment of shell. Another was eviscerated by a jagged splinter. A third was struck in the rump by an unexploded ricochet and hurled 10 feet, though he suffered only bruises as a result. Then came Winder's turn. Tall and wavy-haired, he kept his post, and as he continued to direct the counter-battery fire, calm and cool-looking in his shirt-sleeves, with the binoculars held to his eyes, a shell came screaming at him, crashing through his left arm and tearing off most of the ribs on that side of his chest. He fell straight back and lay full length on the ground, quivering spasmodically. "General, do you know me?" a staff lieutenant asked, bending over the sufferer in order to be heard above the thunder of the guns. "Oh, yes," Winder said vaguely, and his mind began to wander. The guns were bucking and banging all around him, but he was back at home again in Maryland. In shock, he spoke disconnectedly of his wife and children until a chaplain came and knelt beside him, seeking to turn his thoughts from worldly things. "General, lift up your head to God." "I do," Winder said calmly. "I do lift it up to him." Carried to the rear, he died just at sundown, asking after the welfare of his men, and those who were with him were hard put for a comforting answer. By then the fury of the Union assault had crashed against his lines, which had broken in several places. Jackson's plan for outflanking the enemy on the left had miscarried. It was he who was outflanked in that direction. The sudden crash of musketry, following close on the news that Winder had been mangled by a shell, brought him off the farmhouse porch and into the saddle. He rode hard toward the left, entering a moil of fugitives who had given way in panic when the bluecoats emerged roaring from the cover of the woods. Drawing his sword, a thing no one had ever seen him do before in battle, he brandished it above his head and called out hoarsely, "Rally, brave men, and press forward! Your general will lead you. Jackson will lead you. Follow me!" This had an immediate effect, for the sight was as startling in its way as the unexpected appearance of the Federals had been. The men halted in their tracks, staring open-mouthed, and then began to rally in response to the cries of their officers, echoing Stonewall, who was finally persuaded to retire out of range of the bullets twittering round him. "Good, good," he said as he turned back, Winder's successor having assured him that the Yankees would be stopped. Whether this promise could have been kept in the face of another assault was another matter, but fortunately by now the battle was moving in the opposite direction. A.P. Hill had arrived with the light division. Opening ranks to let the fugitives through, Little Powell's veterans swamped the blue attackers, flung them back on their reserves, and pursued them northward through the gathering twilight. So quickly, after the manner of light fiction, had victory been snatched from the flames of defeat, if not disaster. Thankful as Jackson was for this deliverance, he was by no means satisfied. Banks had escaped him once before. He did not intend to let him get away again. A full moon was rising, and he ordered the chase continued by its light. Whenever resistance was encountered, he passed his guns to the front, shelled the woods, and then resumed the pursuit, gathering shell-dazed prisoners as he went. 400 bluecoats were captured in all, bringing the total Federal losses to 2,381. Jackson himself had lost 1,276. At last, however, receiving word from his cavalry that the enemy had been heavily reinforced, he called a halt within half a dozen miles of Culpeper and passed the word for his men to sleep on their arms in line of battle. He himself rode back toward Cedar Mountain, seeking shelter at roadside houses along the way. At each he was told that he was welcome, but that the wounded filled the rooms. Finally he drew rein beside a grassy plot, dismounted stiffly, and lay face down on the turf, wrapped in a borrowed cloak. When a staff officer asked if he wanted something to eat, "No," he groaned, "I want rest, nothing but rest," and was soon asleep. Sunday, August 10th, dawned hot and humid, the quiet broken only by the moans and shrieks of the injured, blue and gray, presently augmented by their piteous cries for water as the sun rose burning, stiffening their wounds. Surgeons and aid men passed among them, and burial details came along behind. The scavengers were active too, gleaning the field of arms and equipment. As usual, old Blue Light wanted all he could lay hands on. Thus the morning wore away, and not a shot was fired. Aware that Siegel and McDowell had arrived to give Pope two whole corps and half of a third, King was still on the way from Fredericksburg, where Burnside was on call, Jackson would not deliver a Sabbath attack, but he was prepared to receive one, whatever the odds, so long as there were wounded men to be cared for and spoils to be loaded into his wagons. That afternoon, as always, seemed to be the case on the morrow of a battle. The weather broke. There were long peals of thunder, followed by rain. Jackson held his ground, and the various details continued their work into the night. Next morning, a deputation of federal horsemen came forward under a flag of truce, proposing an armistice for the removal of the wounded. Jackson gladly agreed, for King's arrival that night would give Pope better than twice as many troops as he himself had, and this would afford him additional time in which to prepare for the withdrawal he now knew was necessary. While the soldiers of both armies mingled on the field where they had fought, he finished packing his wagons and got off a message to Lee. "God blessed our arms with another victory." When darkness came, he lighted campfires all along his front, stole away southward under cover of their burning, and recrossed the Rapidan, unmolested, unpursued. "Another victory," he called it, not without justification. He had inflicted 1,000 more casualties than he suffered, and for 2 days after the battle he had remained in control of the field. Yet there were other aspects he ignored. Banks had done to him what he had tried to do to Shields at Kernstown, and what was more, had done it with considerably greater success, even apart from the initial rout. For in the end it was Stonewall who retreated. But now that the roles were reversed, he applied a different set of standards. Privately, according to his chief of staff, he went so far as to refer to Cedar Mountain as the most successful of his exploits. Few would agree with him in this, however, even among the men in his own army. They had been mishandled, and they knew it. Outnumbering the enemy 3-1 on the field of fight, he had been careless in reconnaissance, allowing his troops to be outflanked while he drowsed on a farmhouse veranda, and had swung into vigorous action only after his left wing had been shattered. Following as it did his sorry performance throughout the 7 days, the recrossing of the Rapidan gave point to a question now being asked. Had Stonewall lost his touch? Arrogant was the word applied by some. Others remarked that his former triumphs had been scored against second raters out in the valley, but when pitted against the best of the federal commanders, he did not appear so well. Then, too, there had always been those who considered him crazy. Crazy and, so far, lucky. "Give him a month uncontrolled," one correspondent declared, "and he would destroy himself and all under him." Time, perhaps, would show who was right, the general or his critics, but for the present at least two other men derived particular satisfaction from the battle and its outcome, despite the fact that they viewed it from opposite directions. One of the two was A.P. Hill, still fuming because of the undeserved rebuke he had received on the outskirts of Orange the day before. He had marched toward the sound of firing and reached the field to find his tormentor face to face with disaster. After opening his ranks to let the fugitives through, including hundreds from the Stonewall Brigade itself, he had launched the counterattack that saved the day and provided whatever factual basis there was for Jackson's claim to another victory. Revenge was seldom sweeter. Hill enjoyed it to the full. The other satisfied observer was John Pope, who celebrated his Eastern debut as a fighting man by publishing, for the encouragement of his army, Halleck's personal congratulations on your hard-earned but brilliant success against vastly superior numbers. Your troops have covered themselves with glory. Pope thought so too now, although at first he'd experienced definite twinges of anxiety and doubt. Alarmed by what had happened to Banks as a result of misinterpreting the verbal message garbled by Lee's nephew, he had hastened to assemble his 8 divisions, including King's, which arrived Monday evening to give him well over 50,000 men, for a renewal of the contest on the morning after the armistice expired. While Jackson was stealing away in the darkness behind a curtain of blazing campfires, Pope was wiring Halleck, "The enemy has been receiving reinforcements all day. I think it almost certain that we shall be attacked in the morning, and we shall make the best fight we can." This did not sound much like the belligerent commander who had urged his subordinates to discard such ideas as the one of taking strong positions and holding them. However, when he found Stonewall gone with the dawn, he recovered his former tone and notified Halleck, "The enemy has retreated under cover of the night. Our cavalry and artillery are in pursuit. I shall follow with the infantry as far as the Rapidan." Now it was Halleck's turn to be alarmed. "Beware of a snare," he quickly replied. "Feigned retreats are secesh tactics." But he need not have worried, not just yet. Pope was content to follow at a distance, and when he reached the near bank of the Rapidan, he stopped as he had said he would do. Presently he fell back toward Culpeper, pausing along the way to publish Halleck's congratulations. He was delighted and astonished, he told his soldiers, at their gallant and intrepid conduct. Whatever their reaction to this astonishment might be, he went on to venture a prophecy. "Success and glory are sure to accompany such conduct, and it is safe to predict that Cedar Mountain is only the first in a series of victories which shall make the Army of Virginia famous in the land." Lee saw it otherwise. Pleased with Jackson's repulse of Banks, he congratulated him most heartily on the victory which God has granted you over our enemies, and expressed the hope that it was but the precursor of others over our foe in that quarter, which will entirely break up and scatter his army. However, the withdrawal to Gordonsville on August 12th, despite Stonewall's subsequent double-barreled explanation that it was done in order to avoid being attacked by the vastly superior force in front of me, and with the hope that by thus falling back General Pope would be induced to follow me until I should be reinforced, not only ended the prospect that his lieutenant would be able to suppress Pope and return to Richmond in time to help deal with McClellan, it also re-exposed the Virginia Central. This was as intolerable now as it had been a month ago, and Lee moved promptly to meet the threat the following day by ordering Longstreet to Gordonsville with 10 brigades, which reduced by half the army remnant protecting the capital from assault on the east and south. Simultaneously, he sent Hood, who now commanded a demi-division composed of his own and Law's brigades, to Hanover Junction in order to block an advance from Fredericksburg. Or if Burnside moved westward to join Pope, Hood could parallel his march and join Jackson. Something of a balance was thus maintained in every direction except McClellan's, potentially the most dangerous of them all. Still, potential was a long way from kinetic, especially where McClellan was concerned. A week ago, when the Bluecoats marched up Malvern Hill and then back down again, Lee had said of him, "I have no idea that he will advance on Richmond now." He took the risk, not thinking it great, and presently found it even smaller than he had supposed. On this same August 13th, while Longstreet's men were boarding the cars for their journey out to the Piedmont, an English deserter came into the southern lines with a story that part of McClellan's army was being loaded onto transports. Next day, this was confirmed by D.H. Hill, whose scouts on the south side of the James reported Fitz John Porter's corps already gone. That was enough for Lee. Convinced that Pope was about to be reinforced from the peninsula, though he did not know to what extent, he decided to turn his back on Little Mac and give his undivided close-up personal attention to the miscreant on the Rapidan. The time was short. Before he went to bed that night, he notified Davis, "Unless I hear from you to the contrary, I shall leave for Gordonsville at 4 a.m. tomorrow. The troops are accumulating there, and I must see that arrangements are made for the field. Tactfully, for he expected to be busy, and he understood the man with whom he dealt, he added, "When you do not hear from me, you may feel sure that I do not think it necessary to trouble you. I shall feel obliged to you for any directions you may think proper to give." In this sequence of events, Halleck's worst fears moved toward realization. The federal dilemma, as he saw it, was that the rebels might concentrate northward and jump Pope before McClellan completed his roundabout transfer from the James to the Rappahannock. The Southern commander had already proved himself an opponent not to be trusted with the initiative, yet that was precisely what he would have so long as the Army of the Potomac was in transit. The contest was in the nature of a race, with the Army of Virginia as the prize to be claimed by whichever of the two superior armies moved the fastest. Lee was not long in seeing it that way, too, and once he had seen it, he acted. In fact, necessity in this case being not only the mother of invention but also the first cousin to prescience, he acted before he saw it, first by detaching Jackson, then by reinforcing him with Hill, finally by sending Longstreet up to reinforce them both, so that, in a sense, he was already running before he heard the starting gun. And now that he heard it, he ran faster. As a result, he not only got there first, he got there before McClellan had done much more than lift his knees off the cinders. Yet that was all. Fortune's smile changed abruptly to a frown. Having reached the finish line, Lee found himself unable to break the ribbon he was breasting. The ribbon was the Rapidan, and Pope was disposed behind it. However, it was not the Union commander who forestalled the intended destruction, but rather a recurrence of the malady which had plagued the Confederates throughout the 7 days: lack of coordination. Detraining at Gordonsville on August 15th, Lee conferred at once with Longstreet and Jackson, who showed him on the map how rare an opportunity lay before him. 9 miles this side of Fredericksburg, the Rapidan and the Rappahannock converged to form the apex of a V laid on its side, with the open end to the west. Pope's attitude within the V, and consequently the attitude of the 50-odd thousand soldiers he had wedged in there between the constricting rivers, was not unlike that of a browsing ram with his attendant flock. Unaware that the butcher was closing in, he had backed himself into a fence corner, apparently in the belief that he and they were safer so. In this he was considerably mistaken, as Lee was now preparing to demonstrate. Across the open end of the V, at an average distance of 20 miles from the apex, ran the Orange and Alexandria Railroad, leading back to Manassas Junction, the Army of Virginia's main supply base. While the infantry of the Army of Northern Virginia was being concentrated behind Clark's Mountain, masked from observation from across the Rapidan, the cavalry would swing upstream, cross in the darkness, and strike for Rappahannock Station. Destruction of the railroad bridge at that point, severing Pope's supply line and removing his only chance for a dry-shod crossing of the river in his rear, would be the signal for the infantry to emerge from hiding and surge across the fords to its front. Pope's army, caught off balance, would be tamped into the cul-de-sac and mangled. Both wing commanders approved of the plan. Jackson, in fact, was so enthusiastic that he proposed to launch the assault tomorrow. But Longstreet, as on the eve of the 7 days, and no doubt recalling the Valley General's faulty logistics on that occasion, suggested a one-day wait. Moreover, though he approved of the basic strategy proposed, he thought better results would be obtained by moving around the enemy right, where the army could take up a strong defensive position in the foothills of the Blue Ridge, forcing Pope to attack until bled white, too fagged to flee, he could be counterattacked and smothered. Lee agreed to the delay, which was necessary anyhow, the cavalry not having arrived, but preferred to assault the enemy left, so as to come between Pope and whatever reinforcements might try to join him, by way of Fredericksburg, either from Washington or the peninsula. Next day it was so ordered. The army would take up masked positions near the Rapidan on Sunday, August 17th, and be prepared to cross at dawn of the following day on receiving word that the bridge was out at Rappahannock Station. That was when things started going wrong, particularly in the cavalry. Stuart had two brigades, one under Wade Hampton, left in front of Richmond, the other under Fitzhugh Lee, the army commander's nephew, stationed at Hanover Junction. The latter was to be used in the strike at Rappahannock Station. He was expected Sunday night, and Stuart rode out to meet him east of Clark's Mountain in rear of Raccoon Ford. Midnight came. There was no sign of him. Jeb and his staff decided to get some sleep on the porch of a roadside house. Just before dawn, hearing hoofbeats in the distance, two officers rode forward to meet what they thought was Lee, but met instead a spatter of carbine fire and came back shouting, "Yankees!" Stuart and the others barely had time to jump for their horses and get away in a hail of bullets, leaving the general's plumed hat, silk-lined cape, and haversack for the blue troopers, who presently withdrew across the river, whooping with delight as they passed the captured finery around. Subsequently, it developed that the ford had been left unguarded by Robert Toombs, who, feeling mellow on his return from a small hour's celebration with some friends, had excused the pickets. Placed in arrest for his neglect, he defied regulations by buckling on his sword and making an impassioned speech to his brigade, whereupon he was relieved of command and ordered back to Gordonsville, much to the discomfort of his troops. This did little to ease Stuart's injured pride and nothing at all to recover his lost plumage. Skilled as he was at surprising others, the laughing cavalier was not accustomed to being surprised himself. Nor were matters improved by the infantryman who greeted him for several days thereafter with the question, "Where's your hat?" Fitz Lee's non-arrival, which required a one-day postponement of the attack, it was as well, not all the infantry brigades were in position anyhow, was explained by the fact that, his orders having stressed no need for haste, he had marched by way of Louisa to draw rations and ammunition. When this was discovered, it caused another one-day postponement, the attack now being set for August 20th. Even this second delay seemed just as well. Pope appeared oblivious and docile, and in the interim Lee would have time to bring another division up from Richmond. Before nightfall on the 18th, however, word came to headquarters that the Federals were breaking camp and retiring toward Culpeper. Next morning Lee climbed to a signal station on Clark's Mountain and saw for himself that the report was all too true. The sea of tents had disappeared. Long lines of dark-clothed men and white-topped wagons, toy-like in the distance, were winding away from the bivouac areas, trailing serpentine clouds of dust in the direction of the Rappahannock. After watching for a time this final evidence of Pope's escape from the destruction planned for him there between the rivers, Lee put away his binoculars, took a deep breath, and said regretfully to Longstreet, who stood beside him on the mountaintop, "General, we little thought that the enemy would turn his back upon us thus early in the campaign." If there could be no envelopment, at least there could be a pursuit. Lee crossed the Rapidan the following day, only to find himself breasting another ribbon he could not break. This time, too, the ribbon was a river, the Rappahannock, but the failure to cross this second stream was not so much due to a lack of efficiency in his own army as it was to the high efficiency of his opponents. Pope knew well enough now what dangers had been hanging over his head, for he had captured, along with Stuart's plume, certain dispatches showing Lee's plan for his destruction. And in spite of his early disparagement of defensive tactics, he was displaying a real talent for such work. After pulling out of the suicidal V, he skillfully took position behind its northern arm, and for two full days, four times around the clock, wherever Lee probed for a crossing, there were solid ranks of Federals, well supported by artillery, drawn up to receive him on the high left bank of the Rappahannock. Notified of the situation, Halleck wired, "Stand firm on that line until I can help you. Fight hard, and aid will soon come." Pope replied, "You may rely upon our making a very hard fight in case the enemy advances." Halleck, preferring firmer language, repeated his instructions. "Dispute every inch of ground and fight like the devil till we can reinforce you. 48 hours more and we can make you strong enough." Encouraged by this pep talk, as well as by his so far success in preventing a crossing of the river to his front, Pope reassured the wrought-up Washington commander, "There need be no apprehension, as I think no impression can be made on me for some days." Once more, Lee was in disagreement. He not only intended to make what his opponent called an impression, he knew he had to make one soon or else give up the game. Information from Richmond, added to what he gleaned from northern papers, had convinced him by now that the whole Army of the Potomac was on its way to the Rappahannock. Burnside's troops, under Major General Jesse L. Reno, had already joined Pope, bringing his total strength to 70,000, according to Lee's computations, and this figure would in turn be more than doubled when McClellan's men arrived. To oppose this imminent combination, Lee himself had 55,000 of all arms, plus 17,000 still at Richmond. Manifestly, with the odds getting longer every day, whatever was to be done must be done quickly. At any rate, the present stalemate was intolerable. Perhaps one way to break it, Lee reasoned, would be to startle Pope and make him jump by sending Stuart to probe at his rear, particularly the Orange and Alexandria Railroad, which stretched like an exposed nerve back to his base at Manassas. Stuart thought so too. Ever since the loss of his plume 5 days ago near Raccoon Ford, he had been chafing under the jibes and begging Lee to turn him loose. "I intend to make the Yankees pay for that hat," he had written his wife. He took off on the morning of August 22nd, crossing the Rappahannock at Waterloo Bridge with 1,500 troopers and 2 guns. His goal was Catlett's Station on the O&A, specifically the bridge over Cedar Run, just south of there, and he intended to reach it by passing around the rear of Pope's army, which was drawn up along the east bank of the river north of Rappahannock Station, to contest a crossing by Lee's infantry. During a midday halt at Warrenton, a young woman informed him that she had wagered a bottle of wine against a Union quartermaster's boast that he would be in Richmond within 30 days. "Take his name and look out for him," Stuart told one of his staff. The column pushed on toward Auburn Mills, rounding the headwaters of Cedar Run, and then proceeded southeastward down the opposite watershed. At sunset, a violent storm broke over the troopers' heads. Night came early. "The darkest night I ever knew," Stuart called it. But he pressed on, undetected in the rain and blackness, and within striking distance of Catlett's was rewarded with a piece of luck, in the form of a captured orderly, a contraband, who, professing his joy at being once more among his own people, offered to guide them to the private quarters of General Pope himself. Stuart took him up on that. Surrounding the brightly lighted camp, he had the bugler sound the charge, and 1,000 yelling horsemen emerged from the outer darkness, swinging sabers and firing revolvers. The startled bluecoats scattered, and the troopers pursued them, spotting targets by the sudden glare of lightning. It was strange. A lightning flash would show the road filled with running men, then the next would show it empty. The runners vanished. Despite the effectiveness of evasive tactics, which appeared to enlist the aid of the supernatural, more than 200 prisoners and about as many horses were rounded up, including a number of staff officers and blooded animals, along with a good deal of miscellaneous loot. From Pope's tent, though the general himself, fortunately or unfortunately, was away on a tour of inspection, the raiders appropriated his personal baggage, a payroll chest stuffed with $350,000 in greenbacks, and a dispatch book containing headquarters copies of all messages sent or received during the past week. The railroad bridge over Cedar Run, however, the prime objective of the raid, resisted all attempts at demolition. Too wet to burn, too tough to chop, it had to be left intact when Stuart pulled out before dawn, returning the way he had come. By daylight, one bedraggled trooper remarked, "Guns, horses, and men looked as if the whole business had passed through a shower of yellow mud last night." But Stuart's spirits were undampened. At Warrenton, he called a halt in front of the young woman's house and had the captured quartermaster brought forward to collect the wagered bottle of wine for drinking in Libby prison. Fitzlee was in equally high spirits. Safely back across Waterloo Bridge that afternoon, he hailed an infantry brigadier and said he had something to show him. Stepping behind a large oak, he presently emerged wearing the cockaded hat and blue dress coat of a federal major general. The infantryman roared with laughter, for the coat was so much too long for the bandy-legged Lee that the hem of it nearly covered his spurs. Stuart laughed hardest of all, and when he saw the name John Pope on the label inside the collar, he extended the joke by composing a dispatch addressed to the former owner. "You have my hat and plume. I have your best coat. I have the honor to propose a cartel for a fair exchange of the prisoners." Although nothing came of this, the coat was sent instead to Richmond, where it was put on display in the state library. Stuart was quite satisfied. "I have had my revenge out of Pope," he told his wife. Pope's coat was a prize R.E. Lee could appreciate as well as the next man, not excepting his charade-staging nephew. But more important to him by far was the captured dispatch book, which reached his headquarters the following morning, August 24th. In it he found laid before him, as if he were reading over his adversary's shoulder, a sequent and detailed account of the federal build-up beyond the Rappahannock. In addition to Reno, whose two divisions had already joined, Pope had other forces close at hand, including one on its way from western Virginia by rail and canal boat. Most urgent, though, was the news that Porter, whose corps was the advance unit of McClellan's army, had debarked at Aquia Creek 3 days ago and marched next day to Falmouth, which placed him within 20 miles of Pope's left at Kelly's Ford, 5 miles downstream from Rappahannock Station. He might have joined it today, or yesterday for that matter, along with Heintzelman, whose corps was reported steaming northward close behind him. 48 hours more and we can make you strong enough," Halleck had wired Pope, and Pope had replied, "There need be no apprehension." That, too, was 3 days ago, while Porter's men were filing off their transports. The race was considerably nearer its finish than Lee had supposed. In point of fact, it was over. Pope was already too strong and too securely based for Lee to engage him in a pitched battle with anything like certainty of the outcome, unless he could maneuver him out of his present position and by so doing gain the chance to fall on some exposed detachment, Pope would go unscathed. And unless Lee could do this quickly, he could not do it at all, for once McClellan's whole army was on the scene, or even the greater part of it, the odds would be hopeless. Lee then had two choices, neither of which included standing still. He could retreat, or he could advance. To retreat would be to give up the Piedmont and probably the Shenandoah Valley. The siege of Richmond, lately raised, would be renewed under conditions worse than those which had followed Joe Johnston's retreat. That would not do at all. And yet to advance might also worsen matters, since Pope might retire on Fredericksburg and thereby hasten the concentration Lee was seeking to delay. The gray-bearded general studied his map, and there he found what he thought might be the answer. Pope's supply line, the Orange and Alexandria Railroad, extended northeastward in his rear, so that to maneuver him in that direction would be to make him increase the distance between his present force and the troops coming ashore at Aquia Creek. Twice already Lee had tried to cut that artery. Once, with a blow aimed at Rappahannock Station, which had failed because Pope pulled back before it landed, and once more with another aimed at Catlett's, which had failed because the rain soaked the bridge too wet for burning. Now he would try again, still farther up the line. If successful, this would not only provoke a longer retreat by threatening Pope's main base of supplies, miles in his rear, but would also repeat the months-old valley ruse of seeming to threaten Washington, which had yielded such rich dividends before. In reasoning thus, Lee was not discouraged by his two previous failures. Rather, he resolved to profit by them. This time he would swing a heavier blow. Instead of using cavalry, he would use infantry, and he would use it in strength. Infantry in this case meant Stonewall, not only because his three divisions were on the flank from which the march around Pope's right would most conveniently begin, but also because he knew the country he would be traversing, and his men had won their foot cavalry fame for long, fast marches, such as the one now proposed. Conversely, Longstreet, too, would be assigned the kind of work he preferred and did best, holding with his four divisions the line of the Rappahannock against possible assault by Pope's 10 divisions across the way. This was risky in the extreme, both for Jackson and Old Pete. Pope was not only stronger now than both of them combined, he was apt to be heavily reinforced at any time, if indeed he had not been already. Furthermore, in dividing his army, Lee was inviting disaster by reversing the basic military principle of concentration in the presence of a superior enemy. Yet he did not plan this out of contempt for Pope. Pope the blusterer, Pope the miscreant, had handled his army with considerable skill throughout the 5 days since his escape from the constricting V. He planned it out of necessity. Unable on the one hand to stand still or on the other to retire, either of which would do no more than postpone ruin and make it all the more ruinous when it inevitably came, Lee perceived that the only way to deal with an opponent he did not feel strong enough to fight was to maneuver him into retreat, and to do that he would have to divide his army. Thus the argument, pro and con, came full circle to one end. He would do it because there was nothing else to do. The very thing which made such a division seem over-rash, Pope's numerical superiority, was also its strongest recommendation, according to Lee, who later remarked, "The disparity between the contending forces rendered the risks unavoidable." Today was Sunday. Shortly after noon, having made his decision, he rode to left-wing headquarters at Jeffersonton to give Stonewall his assignment. Jeffersonton was 2 miles back from the river, where a noisy artillery duel was in progress from opposite banks. Lee spoke above the rumble of the guns. "The march would begin tomorrow," he said. Moving upstream for a crossing well above Pope's right, Jackson would then swing northward behind the screen of the Bull Run Mountains, beyond which he would turn southeast through Thoroughfare Gap, the route he had followed 13 months ago, coming down from the valley to reach the field where he had won his nickname, for a strike at Pope's supply line far in his rear. No precise objective was assigned. Anywhere back there along the railroad would do, Lee said, just so Pope was properly alarmed for the safety of his communications, the welfare of his supply base, and perhaps for the security of Washington itself. Lee explained that he did not want a general engagement. He wanted Pope drawn away from the reinforcements being assembled on the lower Rappahannock. Once that was done, the two wings would reunite in the vicinity of Manassas and take advantage of any opening Pope afforded, either through negligence or panic. Jackson began his preparations at once. After sending a topographical engineer ahead to select the best route around the Bull Run Mountains, he set his camps astir. The march would begin at earliest dawn, with the utmost promptitude, without knapsacks, without everything, in fact, except weapons, the ordnance train, and ambulances. Beef on the hoof would serve for food, supplemented by green corn pulled from fields along the way. Ewell would lead, followed by A.P. Hill. Winder's division, now under Brigadier General W.B. Tolliver, would bring up the rear, with orders to tread on the heels of Hill's men if they lagged. During the night, Longstreet's guns replaced Jackson's along the Rappahannock south of Waterloo Bridge, and Lee, who would be left with 32,000 troops, including Stuart's cavalry, which would join the flanking column the second day, prepared to stage whatever demonstrations would be needed to conceal from Pope the departure of Jackson's 23,000. What with the moving guns, the messengers coming and going, the night-long activity in the camps, Stonewall himself got little sleep before the dawn of August 25th. He rose early, ate a light breakfast, and took a moment, now that the Sabbath was over, to write a brief note to his wife. In it he said nothing of the march that lay ahead, merely that, "I have only time to tell you how much I love my little pet dove." Presently he was in the saddle, doubling the column. The men looked up and sideways at him as he passed, the bill of his mangy cadet cap pulled down over his pale eyes. As usual, they did not know where they were going, only that there would most likely be fighting when they got there. Meanwhile, they did the marching and left the thinking to old Jack. "Close up, men. Close up," he said. 10 days ago, still down on the peninsula, preparing for the withdrawal he had unsuccessfully protested, McClellan had warned Halleck, "I don't like Jackson's movements. He will suddenly appear where least expected." This was not exactly news to Halleck, coming as it did on the heels of Banks's repulse at Cedar Mountain. Besides, old Brains had other problems on his mind, not the least of which was the situation in the West, where his carefully worked-out tactical dispositions seemed about to come unglued. Kirby Smith left Knoxville that same week, bound for Kentucky, and Bragg had his whole army at Chattanooga, apparently poised for a leap in the same direction. Lincoln was distressed, and so was Halleck. So, presently, was McClellan. Earlier, to encourage haste in the evacuation, Halleck had assured him, "It is my intention that you shall command all the troops in Virginia as soon as we can get them together." McClellan's spirits rose at the prospect. To Burnside, who arrived with further assurances of Halleck's goodwill, he said as they stood beside the road down which his army was withdrawing to Fort Monroe, "Look at them, Burn. Did you ever see finer men? Oh, I want to see those men beside of Pope's." But there were subsequent delays, chiefly the result of a shortage of transports, and Halleck's cries for haste once more grew strident. So much so, in fact, that McClellan felt obliged to take official exception to what he called his tone. Privately, he protested to his wife that Halleck did not even behave with common politeness. "He is a bien mauvais sujet. He is not a gentleman. I fear that I am very mad." All the same, he made what haste he could. Porter left for Aquia Creek on August 20th, and Heintzelman left next day for Alexandria. Both were to join Pope at once, the former by moving up the left bank of the Rappahannock, the latter by moving down the Orange and Alexandria Railroad. But Lee was across the Rapidan by now. "The forces of Burnside and Pope are hard-pressed," Halleck wired, "and require aid as quickly as you can send it. Come yourself as soon as you can." The bitter satisfaction McClellan found in this appeal was expressed in a letter to his wife. "Now they are in trouble, they seem to want the Quaker, the procrastinator, the coward, and the traitor. Bien." 2 days later, Franklin followed Heintzelman to Alexandria, and Sumner embarked the following day to follow Porter to Aquia Creek. 4 of the 5 corps were gone, leaving Keyes to man the Yorktown defenses. McClellan had answered Halleck's cries for haste, but he no longer put any stock in any promises made him, either by the general-in-chief or by any other representative of the administration. In fact, he told his wife as he left Old Point Comfort August 23rd, "I take it for granted that my orders will be as disagreeable as it is possible to make them. Unless Pope is beaten," he added, "in which case they will want me to save Washington again. Nothing but their fears will induce them to give me any command of importance or to treat me otherwise than with discourtesy." Sure enough, when he got to Aquia next morning, Sunday, he found that Porter and Heintzelman had already been released to Pope, and when he wired for instructions, Halleck replied, "You can either remain at Aquia or come to Alexandria as you may deem best, so as to direct the landing of your troops." In other words, it didn't matter. The young Napoleon was merely to serve as an expediter, dispatching the rest of his men to Pope as fast as they came ashore at those 2 points. He chose Alexandria, presumably to be close at hand for the call he believed would follow the calamity he expected. Monday and Tuesday were doubtful days. Pope's scouts had spotted a column of well-closed infantry moving northward up the far bank of the Rappahannock, and Pope reported Lee's whole army bound for the Shenandoah Valley by way of Luray and Front Royal. Then Tuesday night the line went dead. All was silent beyond Manassas Junction, where there had been some sort of explosion. The next 5 days were smoke and flame. McClellan ran the gamut of emotions. With Porter and Heintzelman committed, he sent Franklin to join them, saying, "Go, and whatever may happen, don't allow it to be said that the Army of the Potomac failed to do its utmost for the country." Sumner followed. "You now have every man within my reach," McClellan told Halleck, requesting that "I may be permitted to go to the scene of battle with my staff, merely to be with my own men, if nothing more. They will fight none the worse for my being with them." Halleck replied, "I cannot answer without seeing the President, as General Pope is in command, by his orders of the department." When McClellan asked where this left him, the answer came from the War Department. "General McClellan commands that portion of the Army of the Potomac that has not been sent forward to General Pope's command." In all, this amounted to nothing more than his staff and the handful of convalescents at Alexandria. Instead of being removed from command, as he had feared at the outset, he now perceived that his command had been removed from him. He was left, he told his wife, "flat on my back without any command whatever. I feel too blue and disgusted to write any more now, so I will smoke a cigar and try to get into a better humor." It did no good. Far off beyond Fairfax, he could hear the rumble of guns from a field where his soldiers were fighting under a man he despised and considered professionally incompetent. Unable to go, yet unable to sit still, doing nothing, he took up his pen. "They have taken all my troops from me. I have even sent off my personal escort and camp guard, and am here with a few orderlies and the aides. I have been listening to the sound of a great battle in the distance. My men engaged in it, and I away. I never felt worse in my life." "Let us look before us," Pope had said, "and not behind." In taking advantage of this policy, obligingly announced for all to hear, Jackson not only fulfilled McClellan's prediction that he would suddenly appear where least expected, but he did so, in accordance with Lee's instructions, by landing squarely and emphatically astride those lines of retreat which Pope had said could be left to take care of themselves. In point of fact, however sudden his appearance was to Pope, to his own men it was something else again, coming as it did at the end of two of the longest and hardest days of marching any 23,000 soldiers ever did. At the outset, the two views coincided. Like Pope, whose lookouts promptly reported the upstream movement, when they first marched into Monday's dawn, they thought they were headed for another bloody game of hide-and-seek out in the valley. That was fine with them. Rations had been scarce of late, and they recalled the largesse of commissary banks. They swung on through the dust and heat, a long column of striding men whose uniforms, as one of their number later said, were of that nondescript hue which time and all weathers give to ruins. Jeffersonton to Amosville, then northward across the river to Orleans, halfway through the first day's march, which would end just short of Salem, a station on the Manassas Gap Railroad. Where they would go from there they did not know, nor did they seem to care. Approaching that place with 25 leg-aching miles behind them, they forgot their weariness when they saw Jackson standing upon a large stone by the roadside, cap off, watching the sun turn red as it went down beyond the Blue Ridge. But when they cheered him, as was their custom, he made a startled gesture of protest and sent an officer to explain that the noise might give away their presence to the Yankees. So they raised their hats in mute salute as they swung past him, smiling, proud-eyed, silent except for the shuffle of feet in the dust. Flushed with pleasure, for their silence was more eloquent than cheers, Stonewall turned to his staff. "Who could not conquer with such troops as these?" he asked. Wherever it was they were going, they knew next morning it was not to be the valley, for at Salem they turned east toward White Plains, then southeast, following the railroad into the sunrise, blood red at first, then fiery in the broad notch of Thoroughfare Gap. That was the critical point. If it was held, there would be fighting and the loss of a large portion of the element of surprise. They quickened the step, Then word came down the column, Ewell to Hill to Tolliver. The gap was empty, not a Federal in sight. They pressed on eastward to Haymarket, then south-southeast to Gainesville, where they struck the Warrenton Turnpike, which led east-northeast from Pope's position on the Rappahannock, traversing the scene of last year's triumph on the plains of Manassas, across Bull Run at Stone Bridge, then on to Centerville and Alexandria. Tactically, so far at least as it had been kept from the marchers themselves, the secret was more or less out. Disaster and shame lurk in the rear, Pope had said. Now Jackson lurked there, too. It became obvious at once, though, that he intended to do a good deal more than simply lurk there. Stuart, having arrived with all the cavalry, Lee had released him late the night before, he had ridden hard to catch up by mid-afternoon, when the head of the infantry column got to Gainesville. Jackson fanned the troopers out to the right, protecting the flank in the direction of the Rappahannock, and pushed on southward across the turnpike. 6 miles ahead was Bristow Station, where the Orange and Alexandria crossed Broad Run. Destruction of the bridge there would sever Pope's supply line for days. "Push on, men, push on," he told the marchers. But this was easier said than done. They were showing the effects of strain, and there was much less talk and horseplay up and down the column. Nearing Bristow, they had covered more than 50 miles, most of it in blazing heat and on secondary roads, with little to eat but green corn and apples along the way. Still, now that the goal was nearly in sight, according to one admiring cavalryman, the feeling seemed to be a dread with each one that he would give out and not be there to see the fun. Many did give out, especially during this last half-dozen miles. As usual, however, though the column dribbled, blown, and blistered stragglers in its wake, Stonewall showed no pity for either the fainting or the stalwart, whatever their rank. Just short of Bristow, he dismounted and went onto the porch of a roadside cabin to wait for the column to close. He sat in a split-bottomed chair, tilted back against the wall, and fell asleep. Presently a staff officer arrived and shouted him awake. "General Blank failed to put a picket at the crossroads, and the following brigade took the wrong road." The eyelids lifted. Two pale blue chinks appeared in the thin-lipped mask. "Put him under arrest and prefer charges," Jackson snapped. The eyelids dropped and he was back asleep at once. The lead brigade hit Bristow just at sunset. Coming forward on the run, the whooping graybacks overpowered the startled guards and were taking charge when they heard the approaching rumble of a northbound train. Hurriedly, they threw cross ties on the track and began a frantic attempt to unbolt a rail. Too late, the engine was upon them, scattering ties and men, then clattering out of sight in the gathering dusk, doubtless to give warning up the line. Their disappointment was relieved, however, by news that this was the hour when empty supply trains made their run, one after another from Pope's advance depots around Warrenton, back to Manassas and Alexandria. When the next prize came along, the raiders were ready. Riflemen lining one flank of the right-of-way gave the locomotive a volley as it thundered past, struck an open switch, and plunged with half its cars down the embankment, where it struck with a gaudy eruption of red coals and hissing steam. Delighted with this effect, the Confederates gathered round and were pointing with elation at a bullet-pocked portrait of Lincoln on the steam dome. The engine was called the President, when the whistle of a third train was heard. It rammed into the cars left on the track, creating another rackety tableau of splintered wood and twisted iron, whereupon still a fourth whistle sounded. But while the watchers were getting set to enjoy another eruption of sparks and steam, they heard instead a screech of brakes as the locomotive stopped, then backed rapidly away and out of sight. The raiders cursed the engineer for his vigilance. Now the alarm would be sounded below as well as above the captured station. The fireworks fun was at an end. Though he had enjoyed all this as much as anyone, now that it was over, Jackson wasted no time on regret that it could not have lasted longer. Instead, he put his troops to work at once on the job for which he had brought them here in the first place. Destruction of the Broad Run Railroad Bridge. While this was being done, he stood beside a fire, hastily kindled for light, and began to interrogate one of the captured engineers. Across the way, a federal civilian was laid out on the ground. A middle-aged man, probably a politician, for he had come down from Washington on a visit to Pope's army. He had suffered a broken leg in one of the train wrecks. Hearing who his captors were and that their commander was just on the opposite side of the campfire, he asked to be lifted, despite the pain, for a look at the famed rebel. When the soldiers obliged, he saw beyond the dancing flames a stoop-shouldered figure in outsized boots and road-colored clothes, slouched with a crumpled cadet cap pulled far down over his nose. For half a minute, the civilian stared at the plain-looking man his captors assured him was the gallant Stonewall, scourge of the Yankee nation. Then, anticipation having given way to incredulity, which in turn gave way to disillusionment, he said with a groan of profound disgust, "Oh, my God, lay me down." Jackson himself knew nothing of this, which was why he never understood the basic implication of the expression used by his soldiers in almost every conceivable situation from now on. Whether confronted with an issue of meager rations or a charging Union line. Oh, my God, lay me down. In any case, even if he had heard it, he had no time for laughter. Interrogation of the engineer, along with other captives, had divulged that Pope's main base of supplies, 4 miles up the line at Manassas, was lightly guarded and wide open to attack.